very stimulating, the topic. This is really the first one of these foundations conferences I've gone to, so it's making me think about what might be considered my fairly standard, usual lecture, but from the viewpoint of the foundations and foils. And here's what I'm going to do, which is a little different from the theme of the conference. I am going to graciously accept the dowry of standard quantum mechanics. And especially a nice feature of it, or you might say consequence of it, the monogamy of entanglement, which I'll talk about a little bit later. But the perspective of this kind of conference is to try to think about what are beautiful and ugly axiomatizations of something that we all understand. So this is not exactly a scientific quest, but it's an important one. And I lean in the direction of thinking that we don't need to find an explanation for new phenomena that looks a lot like the explanations we've had before. So I guess I'm not so sympathetic with the idea that we should reduce quantum mechanics to one or two simple physical postulates. Rather, taking this dowry and trying to make it look simple and feel even better than the ideas that underlie classical thinking. Rather than talk about that in abstract, I'll try to talk about it in more specific detail when we come to the specific cases. One of the big differences between classical and quantum ways of thinking and especially if you talk to people who know a little bit about quantum mechanics, is the probabilism of quantum mechanics. So by tremendous contrast with classical mechanics, we have a future that is very, very undetermined. All sorts of things are not known even by God, which Einstein didn't like. But the past looks quite different. The things that happened in the past are pretty well known, except that you might say some microscopic things that happened in the past are a little bit indefinite in somewhat the same way the future is. That is, which path a particle took through an interferometer. If you insist on thinking that it took one path, then you have to swallow the idea that after the experiment is over, God doesn't remember which way it went. Or to put it in a Danny Greenberger way of putting it, any God who would desire to remember which way it went, he wouldn't want to believe in that God. An analogy that I got from Bill Wooters in trying to explain some of the strangeness of quantum mechanics, the probabilistic behavior, the collapse. So we start off with some identically prepared quantum systems, polarized photons at some angle, theta, and we send them through a calcite crystal into two detectors, and they behave probabilistically. With the cosine squared and sine squared probabilities. Bill says, this is a lot like an old-fashioned school where the teacher interrogates the pupil and says, are you polarized vertically or horizontally? And then the student says, I'm polarized about 55 degrees. And the teacher says, I believe I asked you a question. Are you vertical or horizontal? Horizontal, sir. Have you ever had any other polarization? No, sir. I was always horizontal. So that's like a very violent thing, and that it's naturally philosophically upsetting to many people to try to understand that. How could something like that happen from something that's so smooth and unitary? Now, I'm going to talk about, well, everybody understands entanglement here, but I'm going to talk about this central feature of entanglement, that is that the subsystems of an entangled system can be entirely random, even though the whole thing is in a pure state. And I am old enough to have, and lucky or unlucky enough to have been in San Francisco in 1967, which was the summer of love when the city was ruled by hippies. And there were plenty of people then who would have, who sort of in a vague way, have understood entanglement, like that. I don't have an opinion about anything, and neither do you, but we're in perfect harmony. But the hippies were not strong in mathematics, so they thought everybody could be perfectly entangled with everybody else. But that's not mathematically, it's not possible. We have the they didn't realize that they were not strong on monogamy. They didn't realize that entanglement is monogamous, and the more entangled two systems are with each other, the less they can be entangled with anything else. So let's look at how this monogamy develops. So I can take a circuit that makes a maximally entangled state of, I guess I can't turn around and point it. What's the laser there? Yeah, there's a maximally entangled state of 2 qubits. And then if I try to share the entanglement with another party, such as the environment, the entanglement is spoiled. And I get only a classical correlation between these parties, or between these parties, or between any two of them. I have only classical correlation left. So in terms of social relations, that would be saying that 2 is a couple and 3 is a crowd. Now, let's go back to this measurement metaphor of Bill Wooters. So we have this these polarized photons, and they hit the calcite crystal and decide to be vertical or horizontal and get measured. But suppose you didn't measure them with photomultipliers or whatever those detectors are. Instead, you tried to undo their random behavior. Well, as we all know in this room, it was a wrong picture to me for me to say that when they hit the calcite crystal, they chose one beam or the other. That is a somewhat of That's something that hasn't really quite happened yet. And you can make it unhappen by putting in a wave plate and another calcite crystal, and they come out with the original polarization. So I suggested to Bill Wooters that if he tried to explain this to his class, he should say that what causes the pupil to forget his original polarization is the public embarrassment of being interrogated in front of the whole class. So, and this connects very much with the amazing theorem that was discovered by many people, all of them quite modest, listed at the bottom, and that probably there are others, about the nature of entanglement and steering, and that is that if a system is in a pure entangled state, one of the parties can generate any ensemble consistent with the density matrix of the other party by making a local measurement. And steering is a bad name for it because I wouldn't want a car that had that kind of steering. If I came to an 8-way intersection and I could choose whether the car went on a diagonal or on a north-south, but I couldn't choose north or... Well, I still wouldn't want that. So it's this thing that we all understand in here, which is quite hard to explain to lay people, but it's very important in understanding how entanglement behaves. Now, kind of an aesthetic preference or a religious preference here that I'm rather sympathetic to is what John Smolin calls the church of the larger Hilbert space, which is to say the habit of interpreting every mixed state as a pure state of a larger system and of every stochastic evolution as a deterministic evolution or unitary evolution of a larger system, and something that only makes sense in the quantum context, of course. But it's nobody can stop us from doing this. It's part of standard quantum mechanics that you can think this way if you want. And I guess the benefit of it, or the aesthetic beauty of it, is it seems to give a way of understanding where stochastic behavior comes from, or understanding probability. And one might say even that if you accept the idea of imperfectly distinguishable states and the idea of superposition, then you don't need the idea of probability because you can derive it from the theory of entanglement. That's the hope. And that's partly what I was trying to say yesterday when I said that you shouldn't think that a superposition is somehow more complicated than a mixture. I think it's the other way around. A mixture is an emergent phenomenon that you get out of superposition. And you can get entanglement out of superposition. So I think actually the axioms of quantum mechanics are pretty simple, although it's a lot of fun to try to make them even simpler. I guess what you say that when one of the efforts, for example, of Ben Schumacher, what was it? Einstein said you should make everything as simple as possible, but not any simpler. And he's tried to make it a little more simple than possible. So anyway, this is an attitude that is, although I characterize it as religious, it seems to be different from most religions that you have around today, except for, of course, the hippies. So this is now a just one approach, but it's the one that I find most appealing to try to explain the emergence of classical phenomenology. From phenomenology from quantum underlying quantum rules, and this is the thing that's called quantum Darwinism by Zurich and Blum Kohut in a series of papers over the last several years. The idea is you have, at least in some situations in the world, this is not universally true, a system that interacts with an environment, and the environment consists of many parts that don't interact much with each other and interact with the system in a commuting way. So we can make a cartoon of this by saying that the environment consists of a bunch of zeros that interact with the system by controlled knots. And when you do this, you get an entangled state of the whole thing, but you get out of it a preferred basis. You get a basis in which the system is correlated with each sub-environment individually, but in other bases, it's only correlated with the whole environment. So this is, you could say, this is a manifestation of the monogamy of entanglement, and indeed, an environment doesn't have to be even more than 2 qubits before this phenomenon starts happening. It doesn't have to be macroscopic. So, as they say, this is not universally, there are other kinds of interaction than this, and this typically happens when the environment is not at thermal equilibrium. I'll talk more about that later. But this is very relevant to our terrestrial experience because the Earth's environment is a lot like that. So it would seem that if we think about the private information that exists in the path and in interferometer that even God doesn't know about afterward, there are 3 levels of privacy. There are this quantum privacy, which is information that can be, that has a transient or maybe a hypothetical existence, There's classical private information, which is this sort of stuff that leaks out of various websites where we think we keep it secretly. And then there's the public information, which is the stuff that politicians lie about. And nowadays, this public information is a real avalanche, and it seems that the world is very different now from the way it was before before Gutenberg and before the internet, because in the ancient world, it was very common for important works of literature to be generated and widely known and performed and written down and so on, and then all the copies would be lost. And so we have a lot of lost literature from antiquity in various cultures. Whereas now it seems that if you blog about something, then it's irreversibly public for the rest of the rest of history. But I'm not so sure whether that is true. In fact, I think it isn't, and I'll give you reasons why I think it's not true. There's a lot of macroscopic information that gets generated in the world that doesn't get blogged about. Although I'm giving you an example of it, but my process of giving you the example of it negates the example. I thought these mud cracks and raindrop craters were very interesting in 1965. That was 2 years before the Summer of Love. So I took a picture of them. But they're not there anymore. And so the question is, a sort of philosophical question is, but really a physical question, does a physical record of these things still exist? Oh, not these ones. These ones definitely does exist, but the ones that are just out of the picture. And I had started off with a prejudice to believe that it does still exist. You say often that when you burn a book, the contents of the book are still present in the smoke and ashes from the book. And of course, probably most people here may be prejudiced in favor of a unitary evolution of black holes. How many people think black information gets destroyed in a black hole? Raise your hand. Okay, how many people think it comes out in the Hawking radiation? All right, well, how about that? This is another example of information people don't care about. All right, anyway, I think I realized that part of my prejudice was that I got very annoyed by, I guess this movement has largely died out by now, but a few years ago there was this postmodernist movement among people who style themselves as historians of science, which sort of denied objective reality and said that science is what people, for their own self-interested political reasons, considered it to be. And so it was pointless to inquire about what actually happened in the past, as opposed to what people thought happened in the past. So I guess I'm beating a dead horse here. But I guess even at the time, scientists were particularly offended by this, not because they don't like information that can be somewhat subjective, but they think that it shouldn't be so anthropocentrically connected, that we are a small part of the universe and what we feel about something shouldn't make a big difference. So I doubt if Wheeler would have been very sympathetic to the postmodern viewpoint. Here's why I think some information is lost, and the reason is that there's so much of it. I'll say it's lost from the planet Earth because we have a very large flow of entropy into the Earth and a slightly larger flow of out in the form of thermal radiation. And uh, I'm, at some point I want to improve these estimates by talking to some planetary scientists and geologists and meteorologists. But a rough estimate can be made by saying the solar heat flux into the Earth, which is most of the energy that comes in and also most of what comes out, although some comes out from radioactive decay and other processes, is on the order of a few hundred watts per square meter. And the entropy equivalent of that is about 10 to the 30th bits per square meter per year. If you wanted to say, well, how could you use the Earth as a giant tape recorder to store a lot of information? Well, one of the best places to do that would be in the boundaries between crustal plates where new crust is being formed, typically seafloor spreading, where you get liquid rock that solidifies and then stays solid for a period on the order of hundreds of millions of years, or 100 million years, depending on how fast the seafloor is spreading. So every time there is some atomic disorder frozen into that rock, it sits there, not very differently from data that you've recorded on a tape, until it gets melted in a subduction zone. So to estimate that storage capacity, you would just take the typical thickness of the crust. This would be the oceanic crust, times the information density, and you can roughly estimate. These rocks are mostly not perfect crystals. They've got a lot of disorder, substitutional disorder, dislocations, and things like that that are frozen in. Estimating that around a 1 bit per cubic nanometer, you get around 10 to the 22nd bits per square meter per year. As the Earth's, or at least the crust of the Earth, is its ability to record information like a tape recorder. So that's a lot smaller than it would have to be to save all of it. So the rest of it must escape into space. Well, what about human information storage? I take a lot of pictures, not only at conferences, but of even more of my grandchildren. And in a bad year, I think I can generate tens, if not hundreds, of gigabytes of data. And so that multiplied by a billion people gives you about 10 to the 21st bits per year, which seems like a lot, except that's for the whole world, not per square meter. So the human information storage is quite puny here compared to what's going on naturally. So in order to catch up with this thermal radiation, you would have to outrun it, which is a little difficult. So I would like to at least tentatively add a new level of privacy, the classical but escaped information that was amplified to the point of becoming classical, and then it escaped from the Earth, and we have no way of getting it back. And then there are the other two levels. Now, suppose we didn't want to store all this macroscopic information, but suppose we wanted to store a real-time video surveillance of the entire Earth at millisecond resolution. That would, of course, be interesting to some spy agencies and things like that. And what would the capacity of that represent? And that would, I worked that out to be about 10 to the 16th bits per square meter per year. So that is well within the geological capture rate. So could it be that instead of sending up spy satellites and things like that, the CIA should be mining the crustal rocks in order to read the record of what has automatically been stored in the formation of these rocks? Well, if you consider the transformation that occurs during this complex crystallization process, so we're saying we have a kind of a hash of everything that's going on in the world is compressed down to this 10 to the 22nd bits per square meter per year. But from the properties of hash functions, recovering a minority share of the output of a random mapping tells you almost nothing about a minority share of the input. So this rock would be actually pretty useless to the CIA, fortunately. Well, of course, some of this information might just come back because somebody was listening for it, or there was a mirror out in space. And if it did, you would say that you could call this information an extraterrestrial fossil. And so even though it had escaped from the Earth, it hadn't escaped permanently, at first we thought it had escaped permanently, but it came back and gave us a pleasant surprise. So in a way, it's not conceptually different from stuff that was saved on the Earth. But if you wanted to get it all back, you would have a kind of a greenhouse problem. That is, to get the majority of the thermal radiation leaving the Earth back. At first, I thought this would produce severe overheating. But of course, if you have that mirror around the Earth, it keeps the sunlight out. So all it would do is allow the Earth to come to thermal equilibrium. But that still wouldn't be very good. So let's see, consider what happens in a representative case of having a raindrop form and fall somewhere. And let's say we have, oversimplifying in the usual way people do in quantum information theory, everything becomes a qubit. So the raindrop can fall in one of two locations, left or right. And this originates in quantum and thermal fluctuations, or if you are an admirer of the Church of the Larger Hilbert Space, it all originates in quantum fluctuations, that is, in the loss of an entangled reference system. As long as this drop or its crater exists, there will be reflected light that strikes it and goes off into space. And it makes this location classical. But then eventually the drop evaporates, or the crater gets washed away, and the earthly embodiment of the information is lost, and all that's left is all of these celestial replicas of it. So let's follow that course from an ontological perspective. What really exists? A fancy word for a very fuzzy idea. So we start off, again, we have the raindrop that falls in one of two locations. And we look at that in the Church of the Larger Hilbert Space way. So it starts off in this kind of state, where it's a superposition of left and right, but a cat-like superposition. So all the terrestrial degrees of freedom, it's a state where it's a superposition of all of them being left and all of them being right. And also the celestial replica that I represent by blue, the light that reflects off, is coordinated with the terrestrial replicas. And we normalize it in the usual way. Oh, it's really hard to look up there. I'll just do it like this. Actually, I can do it like this. I've probably got a pointer here. Yeah, so, there we go. And so you could say that God sees the cat-like superposition in which both things happen. And then it begins to evaporate, and you get more celestial replicas. And then finally, it's entirely evaporated, and the Earth is in a product state with the sky, and the sky is in the superposition. So nothing very, very complicated algebraically has been happening here, but from a philosophical standpoint, you might say that when the last replica escapes, and the Earth is now in a product state with the sky, and the sky is inaccessible, our justification for thinking that one thing happened and the other didn't happen, has become more, has become weaker. And I think Wheeler captured that in one of his aphorisms: the past exists only insofar as it's recorded in the present. And this is also part of the popular culture, you know, flea market. I had the opportunity to buy this little plaque, but actually I just took a picture of it because I was a cheapskate. And I wanted to use it in a talk, so you know, holding it up doesn't do any good. So actually in 1832, if you were there, people would have disagreed with that. There would have been a lot of stuff, but given it 100 and, what is this, is more than 150 years, the people who remembered what happened then and there and all of the stuff that that was there, or a great deal of it might have been, well, maybe something remains, but a great deal of what happened there is not there anymore. And so from this perspective, it says that just by waiting and allowing these processes of unitary evolution and escape to occur, information that once was definite can become indefinite in almost the same way as the path of a particle through an interferometer. So here are some related or subsidiary questions. Do we need a random input from the sun in order to wash this information out of the Earth? No, we don't need it because of entanglement. You can get you can randomize a quantum system without any random input just by allowing entangled subsystems to escape from it. And indeed, if what has escaped and is inaccessible to you anymore is more than half the qubits in the original thing, then the remaining ones are approximately maximally mixed with high probability. So this means that if you took away the sun and replaced it by a laser of equal brightness, things would run pretty much about the same as they do now. There would be less input entropy. There'd be no input entropy. The apparent output entropy would look very much the same as it does now. But it would be functioning as a giant down converter, and all this output radiation would be entangled in somewhat the way as a as the Hawking radiation is entangled if you drop in zeros. Now I'll say, I'll say a little bit more about this. So the entangled, the escape radiation still has a preferred basis, even though it doesn't have a preferred value. And if you think that there's an actual collapse that takes place in the sky, then you can say there is something that happened and we just don't know it. And this is Rüdiger Schack, when I talk to him about this, he says that's what he likes to believe, and he likes to think that Sappho's lost poems exist rather than the wave function of the universe. But now I'm going to move on to a different topic, which I promised to say something about. Can we find a non-anthropocentric definition of complexity? And what is the connection with this and classicality and the universe not being in equilibrium? Of course, we have this idea, this Darwin-Spencer idea of simple causes producing complicated effects. And you can make toy models of that, like some very simple cellular automata, in which we give it a simple initial condition with one small defect, and we get this deterministic pseudo-random consequence, like a turbulent wake. And looking at that wake in more detail, you can say, let's take a piece of it, a biggish piece of it, but not the whole thing. That, in a way, contains evidence for this whole duration of the history. So you might say it has a kind of fossil evidence of the history that led to it, whereas a little piece of it doesn't. And I'm going to try to use that to make a rough definition of complexity, in fact, using the principle of Occam's razor, where if we are presented with a phenomenon and we have alternative explanations for it, we are directed to choose the one with the least verbose assumptions, ignoring the complexity of the deductive path going from this to this. As long as this deterministically leads to that, we should prefer this over that. Now, this philosophical paradigm has been formalized in the subject of algorithmic information theory, and it's done by computerizing everything. The computational path becomes, the deductive path becomes the program, the execution of a program on a universal computer. The hypotheses become inputs or programs, and the object is the digitized output. And the same paradigm leads us to say we should prefer the shortest program as the most plausible explanation for this phenomenon. And once we've done that, we are duty bound to regard the intrinsic amount of computational effort that went into producing this thing as the execution time of that shortest program. That's what I call logical depth. And so a trivially ordered sequence is shallow because it can be computed from a small description rapidly. A typical random sequence is also shallow because it's its own most concise description. It can be computed rapidly from that. So depth is thus different from algorithmic information content or Kolmogorov complexity because that is typically large for an individual random string. So if we take a reversible dynamical system and run it for a long time, let it come to thermal equilibrium, we get a fairly shallow looking state, something like this. And however, the dynamics is deterministic between here and here, so a combination of two time slices would be deep because that contains evidence for the intervening history. But a single slice doesn't contain evidence of its history. So in an equilibrium world is rather different from a non-equilibrium world. In a world that's relaxed to thermal equilibrium, the correlations, the instantaneous correlations, are typically mediated locally. And die out in most conditions with a rather exponentially with distance. Whereas in a non-equilibrium world, like the one we live in, there are correlations that are not mediated locally. For example, I found these two coins that have different portraits of Queen Elizabeth II, and they're both places that used to be part of the British Empire, I guess, right? And the reason that they have this picture on them is not because they were ever anywhere near each other, came out of the same press, or influenced each other. It's because of an entirely different queen here in the past. So this is really just putting in sort of information terms things that everybody knows. But let's connect this with the origin of classicality. Let's take the world and put it inside of that big reflective box and allow it to relax for a time comparable to its Poincaré recurrence time. I think that its state not only would not be complicated, it wouldn't even be classical. The radiation field would not contain redundant replicas of what was happening on the surface of the Earth. In fact, every one of those photons would have been absorbed and re-emitted many times. They'd be terribly entangled. And you could say that the entire box is in a kind of microcanonical superposition of near-degenerate energy eigenstates of the whole Earth cavity system. And those states are typically highly entangled and contain only short-range correlations. So not only would the complexity go away, but also even the classicality. So this is an argument that by thinking about the nature of entanglement, one can understand the origin not only of complexity but classicality. Or to put it try to put it all in one slide, many aspects of the future are, of course, inherently ambiguous because of entanglement, and it's unreasonable to want to know some of these things. An omniscient God wouldn't know them. And the monogamy of entanglement leads to these classical correlations. And paradoxically, it makes entanglement very hard to observe. Everything behaves very classically because of entanglement. And finally, thermal disequilibrium enables both entanglement and both complexity and classicality. Now, how strong is the connection between disequilibrium and complexity in the sense of logical depth? Thermal equilibrium states are generically shallow. This is known from the early 20th century, the Gibbs phase rule. If you take a locally interacting system, allow it to come to thermal equilibrium, most parts of its phase diagram have a single stable phase. It's tricky to get two phases or three to coexist. And this means the system will relax to a state that has no long-term memory, and therefore it can't be deep. There is a quantum exception, which I can talk to you after the talk, in three dimensions, where entanglement actually helps stabilize classical information storage. This last question, what else besides disequilibrium is required for a system to generate unbounded depth and the limit of unbounded size? I don't have a lot to say about that. But let's take a system that looks like it's incapable of generating any complexity. Some water heated from above. Wrong direction for Benard convection. And so you could say it's an analog solution to the Laplace equation. I think this is the same Laplace. But if the water has impurities, because it's out of equilibrium, we could imagine waiting a long time and for a turbine civilization to fluctuate into existence, no matter how unlikely it was for that to happen. Once it happened, it could grow and maintain itself. So it's very risky to look at some system and say, oh, this place is too hot and too chaotic, even though it's dissipative, for anything complicated to be happening there. Could be there's a lot of complicated stuff we don't understand happening in the sun. So this is a question that I don't know the answer to, but this is a good place to end and ask for your questions.
Any questions?
So I wonder, what is the status of scientific explanation given unavoidable escaped information? So certain kinds of explanations involve contingent facts of history.
Involve what?
Contingent facts. Like, I can think of the theory of natural selection, for example. So on the view that, you know, there's escaped information, there's certain things that can be never corroborated.
Yeah. So I would say that the job of scientific explanation is to find a theory within which what we see is representative, is typical. Not to explain every detail of the universe, things like where that snowflake was last year is not an important goal for science, and I even argued it's impossible. But I remember a cartoon about this. I think it was a Harris cartoon, and it showed some astronomers standing around a telescope, and one of them says to the other, if we run our model of the universe back for 12 billion years, we get something resembling Donald Duck. There must be something wrong here. So that's an example of a model within which what is observed is not representative. Whenever you see, this is really the task of inductive inference, and it's very much what people think about in algorithmic information. I don't know if that answered your question. I've got another answer to it. If the questions thin out, I'll give you another answer.
So this is just a clarification, really. I didn't quite follow the connection between disequilibrium and classicality, because if you're taking a quantum Darwinism view of what classicality means, then surely a Gibbs state is is highly decoherent, right? It has a stable, a basis which is stable under dynamics, the energy basis. So to a quantum Darwinist, wouldn't that be counted as classical?
I think what happens is that if you allow a system to keep interacting with its radiation field instead of for the radiation field to escape and never come back, then the approximation that the photons don't interact with each other and their interactions with the system commute breaks down. It becomes much more typical of a generic interaction, even though it's approximately Darwinistic, and if you let things escape, it stays that way. That's why classicality goes away also, I think.
Any further questions?
Well, I have some further things to say if there's no more questions. This is the point.
You've got 1 minute, Charlie.
1 minute, okay. Okay. So this is another philosophical remark. So, and this maybe gets to your question. Can complexity ever be destroyed? Even after a very destructive event, this stuff is still out there in the sky, so maybe the universe is still complicated. And I guess that the answer to that is that I would like to emphasize the difference between the terrestrial and the celestial point of view. If you're going to be sort of religiously orthodox, you would say that for God there is no time. God sees all of it anyway, and it never gets more or less complicated. It's just there. So I think that's a good place to end because I don't have another short thing to say, unless there's another question. No.